Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hello, folks, and welcome to The Hang. In this episode of The Hang, we're hanging with my great friend James Brown III. Now, I've known James for quite a few years now, but I wasn't quite prepared to be so blown away by his accolades when I did some research and a bit of digging in his background before we sat down earlier this summer to record this podcast. James is truly an inspiring person. James has a list of accomplishments that just go on and on. It's truly inspiring to see what hard work, dedication, and perseverance does. I can't wait for you guys to get to know James a little better from this podcast. Without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, my friend, James Brown III.
James Brown III, hello, welcome to The Hang.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. How fun is this?
Yeah, I hope so. You know, I was actually very nervous. So, you know, when you're friends for so long and then you do this podcast and it's always like in my head, I'm thinking, oh, just hang, it'd be simple. But then I get nervous. I think, what are we going to talk about? And I thought, well, let me just look at his bio, you know, because as mates, you take that for granted. When would you ever do that? I made the mistake of actually reading your bio and I was like, holy shit, this guy, you're a genius. You've done so much. And I couldn't believe it. I said to Mandy afterwards, I said, I guess I've known this about him because the reason we're mates, but as well as I want you on a platform like this, I find you incredibly prolific, diverse, inspiring. You got this Midas touch. Now I know why. So we need to unpack. I said, we're going to unpack your bio.
Let's try.
First of all, how are you? You're held up. You flew out to Miami once. I found this amazing too. In this story, I tell people, literally the moment there was a sniff of shutdown, I text you right away. Where are you? I'm on a plane to Miami. It's like right away. I'm out.
Yeah. No, listen, I was walking to my theater on March 12th and I had just read that the NBA was shutting down their season. And I'm thinking in my head, well, it will be awfully irresponsible mm-hmm. if Broadway is not directly behind them in shutting down Broadway. I was like, no, they will. They will. So I go on United Airlines and I put a flight in my basket. Because I'm like, this is happening, yeah. And I will not be in New York City stuck for And then we thought it was gonna be a month. It's like, if I'm gonna be here for a month at the end of winter, I'm gonna be in Miami, at my place, Miami. So the second they announced it at rehearsal, you know, like an hour later, I press pay on on the flight, and I was down here.
I found that hilarious. I'm like, where are you? And you sent me a selfie on the plane. I'm like, how did you know? Who do you know? What's your inside track? Yeah. So how's it been out in Miami all this time?
It's been fantastic. I'm so happy that I came. Having nice weather, I put myself on a schedule. I'm writing from 12 to 5 every day, hitting the gym, enjoying the weather, enjoying family time, which has been really great. My dad and my little brother have been down here with me. So we've had amazing time together that we never would have had otherwise. So it's been awesome despite this pandemic. Yeah.
That's been beautiful to watch on your Instagram. You working out with your dad on the balcony and at times with your brother. Yeah. He doesn't join in all the time, does he?
Well, no, because actually my brother, he's going into his senior year of high school. He plays football and basketball. So actually 4 days a week, he has two a days. So he has a trainer in the morning. His name is Terry Kirby. He used to play for the NFL. He trains him in the gym. And then an hour later, he goes and has he has a wide receiver coach who's taking him through wide receiver drills. He used to be Antonio Brown's wide receiver coach. He's good. he has to be on another thing because he's training for football.
How old's your brother?
17. He just turned 17 last month.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah. He's a big boy, man.
Yeah, he's 6'4". 215 pounds, 212, something like that.
Holy crap. So the pictures didn't, knew that, I knew he was a big boy, but not that big. So he's certainly being prospected, right?
Yeah. So, it's looking like he'll probably end up at University of Maryland College Park playing football there. But you know, that's the tricky thing about what's happening. So at his school up in Maryland, they don't plan on playing football or basketball this last year. So his senior year is kind of jacked up a bit. So my dad and, you know, they've been kind of thinking about maybe transferring him to a school down here in Florida, you know, if they potentially play down here. So then he can get some good tape. But, you know, schools know that this is happening. So they're figuring out combines and figuring out ways to really kind of rate the and recruit the kids despite not having, you know, a season this year. So
combines, are they thinking of like putting all in one area, like a camp with his facilities, nobody in or out?
Yeah. So every school is kind of doing them differently, but there's one that's one kind of national one sponsored by Dick's Sporting Goods where they'll do it in person, but you also, they posted what the combine is, what each skill is. And you can send in tape of you doing it all. Yeah. So, you know,
wow. It's going to be good. Must run in the family. Cause as I, let's go back to you now, James Brown, III. Okay. Who's first and second? Granddad and
I'm not really, granddad and dad, not related to James.
I wasn't
going to
go there. You probably get that all the time.
All the time. Yeah.
So you're born in Baltimore.
Baltimore. Yeah.
How do you say it?
Well, people from Baltimore say Baltimore as Baltimore. If there's a D. I don't claim Merlin. As people from Maryland would say, instead of Maryland, I don't claim Maryland, even though my family are definitely from the Maryland, DC area. My dad is from DC. My mom's from Baltimore. But yeah, I was raised definitely like like the only black surfer beach boy in Orange County.
You can surf?
I can surf.
Wow, that's hard, right? I never tried it, but I can't imagine I'm going to be up on that board at all, let alone more than two seconds.
You'd get there eventually. The first couple of times is tricky. If you learned how to longboard before you learned how to shortboard, you might get up a little bit faster. But it's just timing and coordination. You'd get there.
Yeah, and practice.
Yeah, practice.
Well, so now we can add Star Surfer to this.
I don't know if we can call it Star Surfer.
The seeds of your diversity were like planted right from a young age because you said your parents encouraged any of your passions. And according to your bio, this blew my mind, man. And like years I've known you, we have talked about a lot of things whenever this. Psychology, track and field, drama, football, gymnastics, dance, music, TV, film, religious studies, and fashion.
Yeah, it's true. And I can honestly say that like that list is very true.
Well, I know it is because I've seen the results of all this in almost anything from the way we talk, the way your outlook is on life. I've seen your athleticism. Remember when we did that? The story was about me and I think maybe my workouts for Anastasia and we were at the Chelsea gym.
Oh yeah.
And
oh
they part of yeah, the yeah. workout, for some reason, we were doing sprints or something. I say, okay, camera's rolling. We sprinted. You became so small so quickly in my field of vision because that's how fast you were. And then when I caught up to you, I said, listen, I'm not asking you to let me win, but just make me look somewhat better. There's no gold medals here, son.
I started pulling punches. Yeah, it was the right thing to do.
and you ran so beautifully, like this picture perfect track and field star. And you're like, oh, I did track. I'm like, yeah, I'm sure you have. Let's bring it down a notch.
Yeah. Listen, it's hard. It's hard, you know, like I ran through college. I ran, you know, at a really high level. And so, you know, some things you can't like get rid of.
Nor should you. Yeah. To this day, every time I get on those air runners, I have your coaching in my head. You teach me how to run, how to bring up my knees, where to pull the power from and flick it back. Yeah. I still don't have it down, but we're getting there.
It's all technique and just takes, like we say, it's like surfing. If I can just, can I curse? I'm sorry. It takes practice.
So all these things you were into, these passions you were showing all this from a young age, like through your teens, earlier, after?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. You know, it's for me growing up, especially through high school, I really made my, like, I was a perfectionist, and to my detriment almost. Like, I'm not saying that in like a boastful way. I'm kind of saying it in a way of like, it wasn't great so much for my mental stability. But because I knew the path for me, I wanted to be a doctor. I wanted, I wanted to be a neurosurgeon. Don't ever post this, but Dr. Ben Carson was like my idol. He's an absolute nut job, like looking back on that. And, you know, but he was.
You want me to cut that out?
No, just being silly.
All right.
No, I think it's important for people to realize, like, don't idolize people. But, you know, so anyway, I wanted to be a neurosurgeon. So there was a path to get there. And part of that path was going to an Ivy League school. Part of getting into Ivy League school, there were like steps, right? Like valedictorian, you know, do a bunch of clubs, be an athlete. Like, there was all these things that, like, I put into place that I knew would get me to where I needed to be. And luckily, I wasn't forcing myself to do things I didn't want to do. I just was like, I love this, and I love this, and I love this, and I love this, so let's do it all. And, you know, so I come from an athletic family, so I ran track, and everyone, you know, plays football in my family. And, so just all of those passions that I had that I loved, they were like, go for it. and I did. So it's nice now, having really explored all those things in my 39 years of life, because now that I am writing and creating stories and telling stories, I feel like I have a lot of life and a lot of experience and a lot of passions to pull from in telling these stories and kind of infusing life experiences that I've had into the lives that in the worlds that I'm creating. So it has been really fun to have explored all that stuff and now get to kind of turn it inside out a little bit.
Well, we'll get to your writing, but just to touch on this and something that even now I could probably take this advice on board, because I'd like to think I'm trying to diversify my talents or my efforts. How do you not dilute it? Because you seem to be gifted at almost each of these. And I'm not just saying that to blow smoke. You are. You've done amazing at each of these. I don't know about your gymnastics. I've never seen you, you know, do any of that. So that's yet to be seen. But I'm sure you're awesome because I've seen your hands. Oh, you are good at it. Your handstands are wonderful. There's only so many hours in a day, days in a week. How do you not dilute it and just be a jack of all trades, master of none?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's one important thing to remember is, like, I'm not kind of delving into all these things all in one day. Like, it definitely has been through the course of a lifetime. It's, you know, like, I can't remember the last time I tumbled, but just because there was a point in my career where I was like, I'm not showing you that skill anymore because I don't want to do it 8 times a week. Yeah, there's a time where you're like, I've done that. I've done it in plenty of shows. It's amazing. But at a, you know, Saturday matinee, am I going to feel like doing, you know, a back layout? Probably not, not at 39. So I'm good. I think now what's so important is especially with the time that we have, is creating schedules and the things that you do want to learn, or the things you do want to improve, the things that you are really excited and passionate about, make sure you schedule it in your day or schedule it in your week, you know, to find time for it. And also take the pressure off yourself for needing to be good at it. You know, if the idea of every passion you have is to be good at it, then you're already diluting it in that way. And really it's just like, I love, you know, I'm passionate about tennis. I'm a terrible tennis player. And that's, you know, cool. Like, that's totally fine. People always like, well, learn how to play. And I'm like, no, because I'm never going to be the Williams sisters. I can just like totally love the sport from the outside.
I guess your passion will drive you. You won't.
Yeah, when it's like,
when I look at my passions, I'm rarely thinking of the end game. I just think, how do I get better? And hopefully a career will help. I'll get a career that sustains it, but you just keep going, don't you? But scheduling, that was important. We had this chat when we were checking in a few weeks ago. I was like, that makes sense. Because when you have all the time in the world, it's hard. You could lose, you know, you could just waste it. I remember someone said to me once, you want something done, give it to someone who's busy.
True. Yeah, it is so true. And you know, with this time that we have, a schedule is so important. And I found having the schedule and actually having a cutoff time to end is really important, because then you'll find yourself just like working all day, every day, which is also not the point of what we're going through, I think. So yeah, putting in the schedule, I'm always like, if it's not in my iCal, it's not going to happen. Even from just like little conversations with friends where they're like, oh, let's like do a lunch date tomorrow via Zoom. Like if I didn't put it in my iCal, it's not going to happen.
So you're that specific with your schedule.
Yeah. Cause I also don't want to have to remember it. I don't want to waste time and energy remembering the thing. I just want to open up the calendar in the morning and be like, oh, right, that's what's happening. Cool.
And that's probably part of that perfectionist that you say is part of who you are. So you like that order, and then maybe have some chaos within that, but you need to have some structure.
I do like the order. Yeah.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
And I will say one thing, that the reason I don't feel like I'm not as crazy as I was in high school. One major reason, and I'm so happy that I ended up going to Brown for college. And if anyone knows anything about Brown, of all the Ivy League schools, it's definitely the most liberal. It's the most like loosey goosey, artsy fartsy of all the Ivy League schools. But it really taught me to relax, which I needed. There were some others that I was, you know, like Yale was really a close contender. And I know that I would probably be a ridiculous OCD if I had gone to Yale. I'm happy that I finally learned to relax and like not be take things too as seriously as I had been.
Well, that's true, because I've never known you to be anything other than fun, just really good at what you set your mind to, you know? So you went to Brown for psychology, right?
I did, yeah.
Just tell me this. So you were valedictorian?
In high school, yeah, I was.
Embarrassed to say, exactly what is that? I see it. I hear it all the time on all the American shows, valedictorian. We never had that in Canada. Yeah. At least I don't think. Maybe we did.
I mean, some school system. I mean, like, I'm sure you had. Maybe you had like some places have like first boy or first girl. Some places have like or lead boy, lead girl, head boy. Some places have, you know, summa cum laude and magna cum laude. Like they're all basically the same. Basically, what usually happens in America is whoever has the like highest GPA in the school is the valedictorian. Some places have it where any students who have above a 4.0, you know, now that with weighted grades, with AP classes and stuff, anyone over a 4.0 is a valedictorian. And then like they choose amongst the valedictorians who's the one who speaks. So I didn't speak in mine. I was one of valedictorians, but I wasn't the speaker.
And I guess all your extracurricular activities play a part in that as well, right?
No, it's totally based on GPA. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. It's totally based on GPA. So at our school, you know, if you had above a 4.0, then you were a valedictorian. And then, so you could be do nothing and all you did was study and, you know.
Fair play. So Brown for psychology,
yeah.
And that was how many years?
Three
yeah. years. And that's what took you, did psychology in like dance psychology?
No. I was like, I was pre-med. I was going to medical school. that was the next step. And so my first year in New York, I was doing psych research on that's male right. dancers. And part of the research was going to auditions. I went to an audition for Michael Jackson, ended up getting the job, dancing with Michael Jackson and giving them, like, I never did the research because I was dancing with Michael Jackson.
Okay. That was a quick, truncated, story. I want to unpack that a bit. You went to the audition for what reason? To think, was that part of your studies or are you just
So the research I was doing is based on, it's called the Adonis Complex, based on, it was the first comprehensive study done on male body image, dysmorphia, anorexia, bulimia. And it was done by a professor at Brown and a professor at Harvard. They wrote a book called the Adonis Complex. And the book is amazing. The cross-section of men that they research was amazing. And I actually felt like there could have been more on male dancers because male dancers grow up staring at themselves in the mirror. So they have to have some level of body dysmorphia. So I wanted to like add to the study by studying male dancers. And so part of the study was emerging myself in the world of the male dancer and also interviewing them as subjects. And so that's why I went. So that's why I was part of the research.
And you just thought, well, I'll go to the audition, see what everyone goes through.
Yeah. And so I could dance. So I was like, well, I can be inside the thing and so I was there and it was my first.
So you were hoping to get the job coincide with what you learned.
No, I don't think so. No, I mean, because that's not why I was, I was there to. Because I knew literally like hundreds, if not thousands of men auditioned. Like the line was wrapped around, it was for Michael Jackson.
Wow.
And it was back in the time where people lined up for auditions, you know? I remember Madonna had also been auditioning for her tour around the same time. It was like people were running back and forth from her. Anyway, and I didn't know anyone. I was, I wasn't in the dance world. I was coming from college, academic. So it was a great way for me to kind of like infiltrate the world from the inside to meet these people organically and not just be like, hey, I'm a researcher, like trying to research you. Do you think your body looks bad?
I like the little dance you just threw in. You look like a Sims character.
Yeah. So that's why. And it just, and I think part of what was happening is because I wasn't there for the job, there was no pressure. Like I showed up with like a white tank top on and some sweatpants and a terrible resume that I made up that looked like a business resume, a headshot that I cropped myself out of. It was a picture of me and my parents like on the beach. I'm like hanging over a tree. I look like a koala, and put like Photoshop my name on it and made it sepia tone of all things. Sepia tone, not even black and white.
Yes.
And, the first cut was tumbling. We just talked about this. So I could tumble. I was like, well, I can tumble. So I just tumbled. And the choreographer was like, can you dance? And, yeah, I can dance. He said, okay, well, don't, skip the open call. Come back later to the agency call. I was like, great. So now I'm like going through the rounds of the day and I keep getting kept. And because I think I'm just like doing the thing. And at the end of the day, the two choreographers were like, hey, Jay, come here. So you're clearly new to the city.
What gave that away?
They're like, this is what a headshot looks like. And they like hold up a headshot. This is what a resume looks like. It's like three columns. Like, you know, this is what you do. And what are you wearing? And they were like, look around. Look around. They're like, yeah, everyone looks like they're going to the club or that they're in the video already. You look like you're going to the gym. I was like, well, yeah. I was coming to dance. They're like, well, tomorrow when you come to the callback, come like you book the job and you're in the video, you're at the club. I was like, okay. And so this is like a week long audition. After every night I'd come home, like call my parents and be like, I don't know what's happening, but I'm still here. They're like, oh, you know, the first day of my mom was like, oh, that's sweet, baby. At least you're having a great time. Are you like meeting the people you need, you know? And then the final callback was at midnight. And they told us that either Michael would be in the room or they would like video him in or something. And we had like danced. And by the end of it, you know, they had like the guys that were left standing in a line, like in height order, and all of our headshots were on the table. And they went down the row and were like, thank you, please stay. Thank you, please stay. Thank you, please stay. And the people who said, they said, thank you to just like walked out of the room. And so then there were, you know, the guys left standing and they were like, welcome to the Michael Jackson, like 30th. And it was, I mean, like what? Like, I still to this day, sometimes thinking back to this story of like, what just happened? This wasn't what was supposed to happen, but you know, here I am literally 19 years later.
So then
it ended up being this thing where it was a huge celebration of his 30th anniversary as like an artist and whatever, that was ending with a huge concert, like weekend of concert at Madison Square Gardens, where the first half of the concert were the biggest pop stars of the time celebrating him, doing like their versions of his songs. And then the second half of the concert was Michael saying thank you, performing like the other songs. So initially we were hired to be Michael's dancers, just Michael's dancers. And then we ended up also dancing with the artists as well, because I know who the producers are. We don't need to say their names. The producers were like, we'll save lots of money if we just have the same group of dancers dance for everyone. So, you know, we did the opening number. Some of us like danced with Destiny's Child and like Missy. And, you know, it ended up being televised on CBS. And so that was the whole summer of like dancing with Michael.
Wow. What a first gig.
Yeah. It's crazy. It was
Did you have much interaction like working with Michael creatively?
Yeah. He was, like Beat It, like he was in the room. We would learn the number, we would learn it, and you know, for a few days, and then he would come in and perfect it and like be there, and we'd block it with him, and he would give tips and things. It was, you know, when he was in the room with us, he was in the room with us. It was, there was no pretense. There was no walls up, you know, nothing. It was just us and him and it was really cool. Really cool.
Was it pretty special watching him create in the room and do his thing?
Yeah, it was, especially because, you know, a question I get asked a lot is like, was it weird? Was he weird? And I have to say he was not. He was the people around him made it weird. And the fact that if we were in a recording studio with him, no one else could be in the studio around him. Like one day Aretha Franklin got kicked out of the studio. She was like in another studio recording. So like there were weird things like that would happen. But yeah, to see this man who is, you know, arguably the biggest pop star ever, whose music has completely inspired and influenced everything. It was incredible. And I was 20 years old.
So then what then? And going back to the audition, and I'm sure your talent, like I said, there is something about you when you walk into a room, but had you not had such a shitty photo resume, obviously look new, Do you think that played a part? Do you think that drew at least attention to you, whether it was good or bad initially, but then the talent then superseded that?
You know, I think mm-hmm. being a new face definitely played into it. You know, the dance world is, especially the commercial dance world, is really small. It's kind of small, and the people that work, you know, are in similar circles. And so being a new face that's like showing up, especially when I imagine at that point, now knowing the system, you know, the choreographers had an idea of who they were going to hire anyway. Right. And also the reality is that it's a physical art form. Right. And so, I'm a 6'1" guy, like I'm a 6'1" black man who I don't, you know, I was coming off of like being in peak shape of track. So, you know, like it just is one of those things that if you're standing a line of guys up who are all in their early 20s, who will be on TV dancing behind Michael Jackson, you know, there's a thing, right? And so, and that's a part of what we do that I think we have to be realistic about and aware of. And so, honestly, I think it just was that. And then once you start teaching choreography, if I'm, you know, hitting it with the other guys that they know, then it's, you know, it helped. And there's my friend Manway, who we ended up dancing a lot together in that time period for different artists. He and I are like the same exact height. We mm-hmm. like complement each other in terms of our abilities. He's like probably like the dark skin version of me if or whatever. And so we ended up being, we would be bookends in almost every job we did together. So we got hired a lot together. They would always be like Manway James got it. And so Manway, we danced together and it's Michael. And so, you know, that's just one of those things that, kind of happened. Yeah.
So that's your summer. And at this point now, I guess, natural crossroads to, you know, which way to go?
No. So, yeah. So, and then, so two of the dancers that were with us for Michael had taken a leave of absence from Lion King. And towards the end of our time with Michael, they were like, can you sing? I was like, yeah, I can sing. I, you know, grew up kind of like singing and like whatever. And they were like, oh, Lion King's having a huge audition for their first national tour. Like they're taking out a first national tour for the first time ever. You'd probably get it. Our last show at Madison Square Gardens was September 10th. September 11th happened the next morning. We were in the city for it. It's like crazy. My parents were in the city because they were at the concert. So they, you know, like whisked me away and we got out of the city.
Wow.
And 2 days later, September 13th, Lion King still had this open call for the first national tour. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, like they still plan on having it. So I went. And in many ways, it kind of was a similar story in that I didn't need this job. They just said that they thought I'd get it. And I was like, okay. So I went in and auditioned. And, you know, it was like a week or so of auditions and callbacks. And, you know, and I think it was just a series of things that played in my favor. The first cut of the audition is this kind of super technical dance cut that all happens to be on the left side, which is most people's bad side, but it happens to be my really good side. And so, you know, so then it's like, well, that's all they're looking for in this cut is like technique. So, you know, and it just, I think it just all kind of played in my favor. And, you know, next thing I knew, I was just, you know, dance captain of Lion King and understudying Simba. So that was my first show. And then from the, when I, once I got that, then I knew that I wasn't going to go to medical school and like psychology would just be something I'd use to keep me sane in the middle of auditions.
And you were enjoying it. Like you were having a good time. And that's such a key takeaway from all this is yes, to have the preparation, the training, technique, the talent, the confidence, but you just got to go in with that carefree attitude. I don't care what level you are, because we are our worst enemies when it comes to putting it on the line. And it's always the audition. Once you get to rehearsals, you're almost like a different person. Before it, you're a different person. Well, at least it seems that way. And it's like,
totally,
be the guy in rehearsals in the audition and just be there, be malleable, take on notes, take on direction, give them something that they haven't perhaps seen, and just be brave and have fun. And I think that's what makes people, because they want to know they can work with you, then do they have the talent to back it? Or are they the guy or person for this job? Because sometimes it's out of our hands.
Because I think that can be a lesson, and it's true for any field, whether you're interviewing or whether you're auditioning. You really need to bring you into the room. You need to bring that person into the room, because at the end of the day, they're working with the person, you know? So if they're putting up a musical, they're a play, whether they're, interviewing you for a job, they have to continue to work with this person. And it's important for them to know the person that they're going to be working with, the person that they're trusting this multi-million dollar, property to. And it's important to show that in the audition. Hundreds of people graduate every year from conservatories who can sing an A, who can sing a B, who can get the leg up, who can, do the monologue, whatever. Like, all those things can be taught and can be trained and can be rehearsed. The thing that you need to see immediately is the person that you're going to have to spend hours and hours and hours with. And so if you just enter the room as yourself, you're already kind of a step ahead of the other people in the room, just because they're coming in. I always say this, they're coming in with a jewel tone button down from Express Men and a pair of khaki pants, because that's what they learned at their conservatory, and they all look like clones, but like, nobody wants that.
I got a TV job that I did. And I remember I prepped my stuff. You went in, the director gave me notes. And I remember thinking at the time, that's some crazy ass notes. What does that even mean? But I thought, I want to always give people the power of their position, right?
Yeah.
Director, I'm not the director. Okay, if that's what you want. So I did it thinking, man, if I get this, I don't want to play it like this. So I got it. We're having drinks in Morocco. And I said, what were some of those directions you gave me? He goes, oh, they're red herrings. I just want to make sure I'm not going to get to the mountain and you're not going to take notes. I was like, oh. He goes, yeah, I'll always throw weird ass direction out in the room just to see, are you going to adapt?
I love that. That's so great. And I wish more people, obviously that was not necessarily something I learned on that first audition, but it is something that I will always say to young actors and dancers and singers auditioning. It's like, walk in the room and be yourself.
Yeah.
And it'll also make you feel better, and you can give them the best version of you, not the nervous version, not the version that you rehearsed over and over and over and over again. Like, use that audition as another day to work, another day to play, not like another day to do the like golden take you had in your kitchen when you were rehearsing it.
And let it be known, I still need to remind myself of this advice, because you put these pressures on you. And for me, like, once I had kids and mortgages and stuff, you carry that baggage in. You can't. You got to put that aside. Remember why you wanted to do this. So where did you got really you became quite the Broadway fashion guru. You started developing things. You were my style. Anytime I was in New York, even up until the album, I was like, James, can you style us? Can you style me? That was always a passion of yours anyways, right? Where did FIT come into it?
My early on in life, my grandmother taught me how to sew. And actually my grandfather, my dad's side, also knew how to sew. So that was something I could do. And I learned how to knit, like in a tech rehearsal for Little Mermaid. And then I ended up, we were doing our out-of-town tryout of Priscilla in Toronto. And I I had this idea to make something for my partner at the time, for his mom. And I ended up finding myself at a furry buying very expensive black fox fur and then going on YouTube to learn how to make a fox stole and then making these two fox stoles, three fox stoles, and then having them being like, oh, I should take pictures of them because they're amazing. I was going to give one to his mom, one to my mom. And then I was like, well, I can't just take pictures of girls in a stole. Like, they have to be wearing something. So then I sketched some dresses that would go with the stoles. And I had, like, I built these sketches off of characters I had in my head. One of them was Cruella de Vil. One of them was Christina Hendricks from Mad Men. Anyway, so I drew, you know, created these, designed these dresses, bought a dress form, bought a sewing machine, taught myself how to drape on YouTube, and made these three dresses and ended up shooting them on these two actresses that were in Priscilla. And I, like, loved them.
What, you made them from scratch? Like, everything, the dress?
From, like, with my bare hands and a sewing machine. And it was, like, there were two dresses and one kind of separate. So it was, like, a blouse and all leather and silk. Like, of course I picked two of the hardest fabrics to use. Anyway, so I found this awesome photographer in Toronto. He shot these amazing pictures of these two women in these clothes. And instantly I was like, oh my God, I love telling stories through fashion. And I felt more like that's what I really wanted to do, was tell stories through fashion as opposed to be a fashion designer. But anyway, so when we got back, I found out that FIT, you could take, kind of create your own program through FIT. So I was like, well, I should learn the industry standards of sewing and the industry standards of draping and pattern making and illustration. So I took a ton of classes there to learn all those things. And that's really where the love grew. People eventually were like, can you design me a dress? Can you design, you know, for opening night or for the Tonys? So now I was like, designing stuff for women for opening nights for Tony's. And then while I was doing Ghost, one of our producers had this idea of basically creating the Vanity Fair of Broadway. And so four of us sat down and created what was then Broadway Style Guide. And so that was kind of the beginnings. I was the creative director and fashion editor of Broadway Style Guide. You were one of the first people we shot. We shot you. You and Sierra and Lena Hall. Anyway, and so from then on, it just, you know, people would reach out to have me style them. You know, again, for the Tonys, for opening nights, for, you know, press award, you know, award season press stuff. And that was really like a good kind of 5 years of my life. And, but again, it was really important to me to kind of approach all of that work from like a character building storytelling, perspective, and really kind of under, you know, even the shoots that I would creative direct, artistic direct for Broadway Style Guide, I always wanted to be like, what is the story we're telling? How are we highlighting these actors in a way that the other platforms don't, you know?
So now, during COVID, post-COVID, you've made the choice to, now you're going to head out to LA?
Yeah. So I had always...
You're writing tons.
Yeah, I've been writing and studying and taking, you know, in school for writing for the last year or so. And it was always kind of the plan to go after my contract was up with Harry Potter. And so the last 5 months that we've had of being off Broadway, you know, I've really taken that time that I've never had in my career to just create. And, you know, I write every day. I've gotten really heavy into TikTok.
I see.
If I might say, quite TikTok famous.
Are you?
I'm getting there. I mean, I have like over 150,000 followers, and
good for you.
You know, it's been fun. But the approach has been, again, storytelling and just really creating a brand both on social media and in practice of telling stories and being a writer and really wanting to use the diverse perspective that I've had in my life to tell stories about what I liked and want to do is telling stories about Black people who do great things in the world we live in, just telling Black stories. So Black stories are great that they exist. It's great that Tyler Perry exists, right? It's great that BET exists. But what it also does is continues to allow for there to be an us and a them mentality. Right. So you can bet that the majority of the audience watching BET is Black, not white, right? But we are in the world that we live in right now, the Black Lives Matter world, because of this separation. And what is important now is to show that we are all people, that we all have universal love and hate and mistakes and triumphs. And we all, you know, in cliche as it is, bleed the same. And so to me, it's important to tell stories, integrated stories, to tell stories where, yes, there's a Black lead living in the world that we live in. I don't actually live in a world where I only surround myself with Black people. There are people that do, but that's not my world. And it's not the world that we want to see in our future. Otherwise, we would have stuck with segregation. And so, so it's really important for me to tell those kinds of stories that really acknowledge the world that we live in and the world that we want to see.
I think that's beautiful. And I think those are stories we all need to hear and should all participate in, because like you say, it's universal, or at least it should be.
Yeah, we will get there, but it won't happen overnight, and it won't happen without adversity and without some ups and downs. It's going to take some time, but we are seeing the needle move a bit. And I think we are starting to get smarter in the approach and in what, you know, and that to make these changes, a lot of them have to happen in our education system. They have to happen on a policy level, a lawmaking level. They actually can't happen on an emotional level. You know, if you grow up in a school and all you know are faces who look like you, and whether that's white or Black, if you grow up in a school in a town where all you know are people that look like you, then we have to understand what is shaping our viewpoint of the others, you know? So it's the media. So we have to change what the media is presenting. It's entertainment. We have to change what entertainment is presenting, you know? And then it's what we see in school, how we're learning, how are teachers teaching about civil rights movement? How are they teaching about slavery? How are they teaching about the Holocaust? You know, and so all those things are what are shaping those minds. And again, it's on both sides. It's the same way that, you know, a Black kid growing up in an all Black area, the way his viewpoint is shaped about white people is going to be based on those things.
I love you, man. Two quick questions before I let you go. What made you smile yesterday?
What made me smile yesterday? Ooh, that's a really good question. Spending time, my dad and I we have this tradition from 8 to 10 where we sit and watch some movie or some TV show we're binging. And right now, or yesterday, sat and watched Hannah, and we just kind of sat and were cracking jokes for 2.5 hours. So that
fabulous
made me smile yesterday. Yeah. My dad's awesome. And this has been so much fun.
He seems very cool. I love watching him. I think it's equal viewing between you and him and your Instagram stories. And last question, what's the first happy childhood memory that pops in your head?
This is actually a funny one for this to pop in my head because it's equal parts happy and equal parts I hated it at the time. So we had this tradition and it kind of ended with my generation, but there was a long history in my family, tradition in my family of all the generations leading up to mine, where we would go down. I have this aunt who had this huge farm down in Suffolk, Virginia. And all of the kids during the summer would go spend a week to like several weeks with Aunt Edna down at her farm. And the farm was passed down in our family. It used to be a plantation that like literally our family were slaves on. And the slave owner, when the slaves were freed, the slave owner parceled out some of his land and gave it to some of his slaves. And so this land was like land that was given from the slave master to my family. And it was a peanut farm that supplied peanuts for Planters Peanut. Anyway, so we would go to this farm. And the reason why I say it was equal parts, like happy memories and equal parts, is like we were all city kids or like not farm kids. And she was really strict and would like make us eat lima beans. And if we got in trouble, she'd make us go pull the switch off the tree that she was going to then beat us with. A switch off the tree. We'd eat like liver, but then it's also fond memories that when we were all together, we like laugh about them. We did stupid stuff. She had a pool that like we swam in every day. And we also like look back and they were like, there wasn't even any chlorine in that pool. So it's probably disgusting. I got a mothball stuck in my nose once. I got my head stuck in a banister once.
Please tell me you're writing about this.
I should. But yeah, that is that's a really fun early childhood memory.
And how do you want people to keep in touch with you? Instagram, you are?
Instagram, I'm at James Brown III, easy breezy.
Twitter?
Twitter, at the JB3, or JB, like JB the third. It's, you can find it with James Brown III.
Famous TikTok?
TikTok, at JB3, JBIII, easy to find. Yeah, I'm actually pretty responsive on DMs and stuff. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
So we can slide into your DMs.
You can slide in my DMs. Like, don't be crazy. People are crazy. Don't be crazy, people.
Yes. And then jamesbrowniii.com.
That's true.
Brother, you continue to inspire me. You make me want to be better at many things. But I'm so glad you're my friend.
I'm so glad you're my friend. Also, I watched your Being Alive video. And I'm obsessed with it.
Oh, thanks, brother. I miss you. I can't wait to be in the same city with you again and do our workouts. And you put me to shame. But every time, I'm better for it. Love you, James.
Love you.
Love you, man. Thanks for the hang.
Thank you.
Thanks for hanging with myself and James Brown III. Like I said, folks, he is truly an inspiring guy with a ton of accolades. All stemming from hard work, perseverance, and dedication. There's a lot to be taken from this. Thanks for hanging, folks. Take care.
The Hang is produced by Dory Beristein and Alan Seals from the Broadway Podcast Network. You can find me online at bpn.fm/thehang. Don't forget, you can connect with me on Instagram and Twitter at Ramin Karimloo, on YouTube, a roaming Iranian, or my Facebook page, Official Ramin Karimloo. Music for my podcast is by my friends and one of my favorite bands, The Dives. Please check them out at their website, thedivesmusic.com. That's thedivesmusic.com, where you can get to know them, hear their incredible music, get links to all their socials, and most importantly, their tour dates, where you can find out where you can see and hear them live. They are truly a great band, and they are phenomenal live. Check them out.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com. And of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.